Chapter 21. Arlington, Virginia. Jose Joe Zavala lived in a small building that once housed a district library in Arlington, outside Washington. His living quarters on the main floor were decorated in a southwest flair with much of the furniture built by his father. He liked the decor for its color and warmth, but it was a reminder of how far he had come from his humble origins. His mother and father, born and raised in Morales, Mexico, waded across the Rio Grande west of El Paso in the late 60s. His mother was 7 months pregnant, and Jose was born and grew up in Santa Fe, New Mexico, where his parents settled, his father being a carpenter who built furniture. The lure of the sea called him from his desert and mountain home. Having graduated from the New York Maritime College as an engineer, Zavala possessed a mechanical mind that bordered on brilliance, and he was recruited right out of college by Admiral Sandecker. Austin had suggested regrouping at Zavala's place to get away from the overpowering presence of NUMA headquarters and the demands of its director. He had experienced the unpleasant task of calling Sandecker the night before to report the sting's failure. Sandecker advised him to get a good night's sleep and return to Washington as soon as possible. Austin and the others conked out for a few hours in a motel near the airport and were on an early flight that had them back in Washington before noon the next day. Nina, who still had a consulting firm to run, hopped onto a shuttle back to Boston. Austin stopped at his house for a shower and change of clothes and checked in with his office. His secretary said she had a packet of information. Austin asked her to send it by courier to Zavala's house. Trout was late for the meeting, which was unlike him. While he waited for Paul, Austin sat at a heavy wood dining table and read the file that had come over from NUMA. Zavala emerged from the basement, where he'd been tinkering with machinery. Austin handed him a black-and-white photo from the folder. This came from the FBI.
"Pretty girl," Zavala said.
The young blonde woman in the photo was not a classic beauty, but attractive in a Midwestern corn-fed way, with large innocent eyes and the winning smile she displayed at the Arizona digs.
"Mrs. Wingate?"
Austin nodded.
"Mrs. Wingate, as she looked 40 years ago."
He took the picture back.
"Her name was Crystal Day. They thought she might become another Doris Day. She had a measure of film success back in the 50s and 60s. Reached her pinnacle doing a clinch scene in a Rock Hudson movie. She might have made it big time if it hadn't been for her expensive alcohol and drug habits and her bad taste in men. The last few years she's been doing bit parts on obscure TV shows, but even those were few and far between."
"What a tragic loss," Zavala said with a shake of his head.
"How'd she end up dead in a shower?"
"Her agent says he thought of Crystal when he got a call, supposedly from an independent film company that was looking for a middle-aged woman for a small role. Immediate opening with big money. My guess is that whoever hired Crystal knew she was desperate and would jump at the chance to do the part, even when she found out it wasn't what she expected and she wouldn't be playing before the cameras."
"She was good enough to fool us," Zavala said.
"Yeah, and so was her husband, Mr. Wingate from Spokane."
"The mysterious scar-faced man with the disappearing beard. Has anything turned up on him?"
"He must have worn his gloves to bed," Austin replied with a frown. "The lab boys even checked the handle of the shovel he was using for fingerprints. Nothing."
"Smart move, having a mole on the project," Zavala said with unveiled admiration. "It certainly took the stinger out of our sting."
"Look at it as a learning experience," Austin said, his voice gaining an edge. "We've learned not to underestimate these guys. We know they're well organized." He tapped the photo with his finger. "And that they don't like loose ends."
"We've also confirmed the TimeQuest connection. They assign a couple of volunteers to the project, then kidnap them while they send in ringers. TimeQuest comes out clean."
Pretty clever.
Diabolically so. What do you make of Wingate's friendly wave just before the shed blew up and the offhand comment the guards told me he made?
Nice try.
You have to admit he had a sense of humor for a murderer.
You don't see me laughing.
He was rubbing it in when he didn't have to. Why?
He just felt like rubbing it in?
Maybe. Austin scratched his chin in thought. I think it was partly just plain arrogance. He was telling us he knows who we are and that he is part of something so big he can treat us as a joke.
Bigger than Yuma?
I wish I knew, Joe.
Austin replaced the publicity photo in the folder.
I wish I knew.
Any idea where we go next?
No more stings. Lucky I was recuperating when that scheme was dreamed up. We'll keep looking into the hovercraft link and the murder.
Not exactly a well-lit highway we're following, Zavala said.
What if I flew down to San Antonio and checked out TimeQuest personally?
Might be worth a look-see.
I'd be interested in TimeQuest's financial backing.
A soft knock came at the door. Trout entered, ducking his head under the jamb. He had a serious look on his face, but this was standard with Trout.
Sorry I'm late, guys. I've been talking to the Nereus about Gamay.
Clearly worried about his wife, Trout had called Numa frequently as they flew across the country to see if Gamay had checked in.
Any word? Austin asked.
Trout settled his lanky form into a chair and shook his head.
They confirmed that she got a ride to shore from the ship, that she rented a jeep, that she left word she was going to meet Professor Chi, the museum anthropologist she's been eager to see, and that she'd be back that evening.
Did she and this Dr. Chi ever get together?
Trout shifted uneasily.
I don't know. The folks down there are still trying to get a hold of Chi. Seems he spends a lot of time out in the field, so they said not to worry. But it's not like Gamay to stay out of touch.
What do you want to do, Paul?
I know you need me here, Trout said apologetically, but I'd like to get back to the Yucatan for a few days to check things out. It's tough trying to follow Gamay's track based on second- or third-hand accounts.
Austin nodded.
Joe's heading down to Texas for a look at TimeQuest. I'll be in Washington working up a report on the Arizona fiasco. Why don't you take 48 hours to see what you can learn? If you need more time, I'll smooth things with Sandecker.
Thanks, Kurt, Trout said, brightening.
I've lined up a flight that will get me down there early tonight. I've got a couple of hours before then I can spare for the team.
Any ideas lurking behind that broad intellectual forehead?
Trout wrinkled his brow.
The one thing we've solidly established is that the trigger in all of these incidents is the discovery of pre-Columbian artifacts.
Yes, that's a given, replied Austin. But we don't know why.
Zavala murmured, In 1492, Columbus sailed the ocean blue.
Austin, who'd been deep in thought, looked up with a bemused expression.
What did you say?
The first line of a poem from grade school. You probably had to learn the same rhyme.
I did, and I don't remember the rest of it any better than you do.
I wasn't trying to get an A in poetry, Zavala said. I was thinking. Maybe pre-Columbian isn't the key. Maybe it's Columbus.
Good point, Trout said.
It is? Zavala replied. Even he wasn't so sure.
Paul is right, Austin said. You can't have pre-Columbian without Columbus.
Zavala grinned.
In 1492,
exactly. That dumb rhyme pretty much sums up what most of us know about Columbus. The date he sailed and the fact we get a 3-day weekend in October because of him. But what do we really know about old Chris? Especially as it might apply to these murderous attacks.
Trout's analytical brain was at work.
I think I see where you're headed. We know there's an indirect link between Columbus and these incidents. Ergo,
Keep on ergoing, Zavala encouraged. Ergo the question. Is there a direct link? They exchanged glances.
Perlmutter, they uttered in unison. Austin grabbed the phone and punched out a number. In a spacious Georgetown carriage house, the private line gave off a ring like a ship's bell. The receiver was plucked from its cradle by a plump hand belonging to a man who was not quite as wide as a barn door. He wore plummy purple pajamas under a red and gold paisley robe. He sat in a chair reading one of the thousands of books that seemed to fill every cubic inch of every room.
"St. Julian Perlmutter here," he said through a magnificent gray beard. "State your business in a brief manner."
"Christopher Columbus," Austin said. "Is that brief enough for you?"
"My God, is that you, Kurt? I heard you've been fighting pirates off the Barbary Coast."
"Just a humble government servant doing my job. Somebody has to keep the seas safe for American shipping."
"Live and learn, my friend. I was unaware that the U.S. Navy had been disbanded in favor of Numa."
"We've decided to give them another chance to shape up. As you know, pirates aren't Numa's usual business."
"Ah, yes. So you're interested in the Admiral of the Ocean Sea. You know, it's a wonder he ever made it west of the Canary Islands."
"Bad navigation?"
"Heavens no, dead reckoning was adequate for the task at hand. It would have been hard for him to have missed two continents connected by an isthmus, even though that's what happened. I'm talking about the crew's food. Did you know that the basic ration was a pound a day of hard biscuit, salt meat, salt fish, and olive oil? Beans and chickpeas, of course, with almonds and raisins for dessert," he said with horror in his voice. "The only bright spot was the availability of fresh fish."
Austin sensed Perlmutter was drifting off onto a dissertation on fine food and wines, his burning passion for which was equaled only by his interest in ships and shipwrecks. Perlmutter was the classic gourmand and bon vivant. Weighing in at nearly 400 pounds, his corpulent figure was a familiar and awe-inspiring sight at the most elegant restaurants, where he often hosted sumptuous dinners.
"Don't forget the weevils that developed in their food," Austin said, trying to move Perlmutter away from his favorite subject.
"I can't imagine what weevils would be like. I've tried locusts and grubs in Africa. Good sources of protein, I'm told, but if I want something that tastes like chicken, I'll eat chicken. You'll have to tell me precisely what you want to know. Why are you so curious about Columbus, if I may ask?"
Perlmutter listened quietly, his encyclopedic mind absorbing every detail, as Austin summarized the story, from the Moroccan murders to the blunted sting.
"I think I see what you need. You want to know why Columbus would inspire anyone to kill. It wouldn't be the first time Columbus excited tempers. He was an incredible survivor. He was wrong about discovering America, yet that is what he is famous for. To his dying day, he claimed to have discovered China. He never acknowledged the existence of an entire continent. He started the slave trade in the Americas and brought the terrible glories of the Spanish Inquisition to the New World. He was obsessed with gold. He was either a saint or a scoundrel, depending on your point of view."
"Well, that was then. I'm talking about now. Why would somebody murder to prevent his discoveries from being discredited? All I need is one link."
"His voyages have produced tons of written material and millions of pages. What has been written about the old boy could fill an entire library."
"I'm aware of that, which is why I called. You're the only one I know who could brush away the dross."
"Flattery will get you nowhere.
I'll repay your work with dinner at a restaurant of your choice."
"But food will. How could any man resist twin seductions of his ego and appetite? I'll start digging right after I have lunch."